Hey folks, welcome to the podcast series for Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. We've got a special podcast for you today. It's a little bit different than our first Thursday podcast where I spend the time reviewing what's happened in the last month in labor relations. This time, I've done an extended interview with Stephen Betts, an attorney down in California, about an issue that's on a lot of folks' minds, both people who represent management and those who represent labor interest. And that issue is, under what circumstances can an employer gain access to an employee's personal cell phone, gain access in the context of some sort of disciplinary investigation? As you'll hear in this discussion, and it's a pretty wide-ranging discussion, we don't really have a ton of case law in this area. Instead, what we're trying to do is build upon the foundation laid in a number of Supreme Court decisions and give our best guess as to what the likely results are going to be. Stephen's thought an awful lot about this issue, and I know you're going to enjoy this podcast. Next up, we have an interview that we recorded with Stephen Betts. Stephen's a lawyer down in the Bay Area in California at the law firm of Raines, Lucia & Stern. That's a law firm that represents roughly about 100 or so law enforcement labor organizations and some firefighter organizations in not just the Bay Area, but increasingly in Southern California. Stephen comes to us with a background both in criminal law when he was at the Hastings College of Law in California. His emphasis was on criminal law, and also a labor law background. He negotiates collective bargaining agreements, or as they call them, MOUs in California, and is involved in disciplinary issues. What prompts this interview is that we got an email. We have a Q&A line with LRIS, and people send in questions, and we try to answer them the best we can. We got a question about a week ago that I thought really was worthy of discussion in the podcast, and the question was this. It came from a police union down in Arizona. The question was, hey, they're starting to ask for our members' cell phones in the course of internal affairs investigations. They meaning internal affairs. What is an employer's right to, first of all, ask for the cell phone? And secondly, if there's some right to ask for the cell phone, what right is there to examine the cell phone? And are there any privacy considerations that come into play? And Stephen has actually written an article for his law firm's newsletter on this issue, and I thought he'd be a great person to interview. So with that as an introduction, good morning, Stephen. Good to talk to you.
Good morning, and thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here to talk about this issue. I know it's a very contentious and interesting issue for a lot of people in law enforcement and in labor law generally, so I'm happy to be here.
Okay. Let's start off with probably the easiest of all scenarios here. At least I think it's easy. You may correct me on this, Stephen. Let's say that a employee is using a department-issued cell phone on duty, and the department receives an allegation of misconduct that involves the cell phone. Can the department access that cell phone without a warrant, probable cause, or reasonable suspicion?
The answer to that question is most likely yes to most things, although I do think let me back up. If it's a department-issued cell phone and it is for work-related or on-duty misconduct, the answer is probably if they have a reasonable basis to do it. That's not necessarily reasonable suspicion, but if it's just a reasonable basis to do it, they can. That essentially is, some of your clients, people may have heard about this case, the City of Ontario versus Kwan. And in that case, that's kind of right now the seminal case on cell phone searches, in the, especially in the law enforcement work world. And in that case, that was basically the scenario in that case where Kwan was an officer who had a department issued. It was actually a pager, but for our purposes, it's the same thing. He was sending text messages over this pager, and he was going over and over and over the allotted amount every month as the department was getting all these bills. And so at some point, the department said, you know what, we're tired of, you know, Kwan would pay back the bill, but at some point, the department just got tired of, you know, checking on the bills for this guy. So they went and got the records of his cell phone texts and found out that, shocker, Kwan was sending some illicit texts while on duty. And long story short, although I think we'll probably come back to Kwan a little bit more during the interview, but the Supreme Court of the United States basically said, in that situation, you don't need a search warrant, you don't need probable cause. It was a workplace search, and it was reasonable.
The court's decision in Kwan, or City of Ontario, didn't it turn on whether the employee had a reasonable expectation of privacy in this device?
Yeah, so Kwan, maybe to answer the question a little bit more clear, I should back up a little bit and talk a little bit more about kind of where Fourth Amendment jurisprudence is with cell phones. I think it's kind of a common theme with especially Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, and the issue with cell phones is when a new technology is introduced to, you know, society, and especially transcendental technology that changes the way that we communicate and changes the way that we really live our lives, the law has to catch up, so to speak. You know, how do we fix this new, how do we put this new technology into our Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, into the framework and principles that we've had for hundreds of years? That's kind of the issue with cell phones, because right now there is no bright line black letter law on cell phones particularly. But there are, I think we can, and this is kind of what Kwan did, the Kwan court, that is, taking our old rules and old jurisprudence, we can basically kind of figure out where we think courts will go and what we think the answers to these questions are, even though there's not really a case up there that says, you know, in this situation X, in this situation, you know, Y, or whatever. So taking a step back, you know, with this kind of stuff, you always start, obviously, with the Fourth Amendment. And as I hope our listeners all know, being police officers mostly, the Fourth Amendment protects against unreasonable searches and seizures. And that generally reaches to, obviously, areas where someone has a reasonable expectation of privacy. If they don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in some place, then a government agency can search it without any basis. If they do, though, you know, there's a general warrant requirement. Although, as we also know, over the years, the warrant requirement has basically, there's so many exceptions to it, your automobile stops, search incidents to arrest, and so forth. Have basically made it so many searches don't need a warrant, obviously. And again, it's just something that most of our listeners are also aware of. So when it comes to workplaces, the main question is, so, okay, we got those principles, but what about workplace searches? Does a government agency, what are their restrictions in just generally searching in the workplace? Well, the main case on that is O'Connor versus Ortega, and I believe it was a case from the 1980s. Supreme Court case, and the question in that case was basically that, you know, can a government employer just go and search an employee's desk or their office or whatever for, you know, misconduct or something? And a couple principles from that case came out, and it's basically, one, of course, the Fourth Amendment applies in the workplace, even for non-criminal conduct. Two, you know, employees don't have watered-down versions of rights. But there's a big but three, there is a general, you know, warrant exception to searches in the workplace just because of the, you know, unique requirements of running a government office and running a government workplace. And, you know, distilling down what the court said, in that case, the rule to take away from it is, if the employee has a reasonable expectation of privacy in the area to be searched, then The searches, therefore, any search in that area must be reasonable. Now, the court agreed on that point. The court did not have a majority opinion on exactly the process to determine what's reasonable. So that's still kind of out there to this day. But the kind of going framework that people have gone with since then is it's reasonable if the search is reasonable in its inception and reasonable in its scope. And what that basically means is it's reasonable in its inception if the employer has some good faith reason to search. Not necessarily probable cause, reasonable suspicion. It's just a general rule. Some places, some things may require more or less. I'll kind of come back to that also.
So what about for example, a government employer? And I know we're back with the desk search issue in O'Connor. What about a government employer that says, you know, look, once a year, I just want to search everybody's desks just to make sure nobody is squirreling away office supplies or whatever it might be? Is that reasonable?
No. I don't think that's reasonable, because reasonableness requires some kind of articulable particular facts to somebody's to a particular fact scenario. I don't believe that a generalized, we're going to give you notice that we're going to come into your office and search everything for no particular reason, that is clearly unreasonable to me. There's no articulable specific basis to suspect anything. And then two, from it kind of going off of that, as far as the reasonableness and the scope, that prong is basically, you know, is the manner the search is conducted, is that reasonable? And a good example for that would be, you know, if you're suspected of stealing, you know, the boss's paperweight or something, the boss can't come in and start looking through all your mail, because obviously the paperweight's not going to be in an envelope. So that's basically the, you know, your workplace search rule. So in the key language, and this is that kind of thing, because often when you're asked this question about cell phones, the question is, what if it's off duty or what if it's on duty? It's kind of a red herring, because I think the issue is, and I think this is the way the court will go, is it work-related misconduct, or is the search for a work-related purpose, not necessarily whether it's on duty or off duty? And this is kind of where cell phones are so unique, because even if it's private, a lot of people will use their cell phones, especially in a law enforcement context. You can use your cell phone off duty and in a private manner. That can still arise in work-related misconduct, even if it's not on duty.
Well, let me back you up here a little bit, because I am guessing that our listeners are going to be very much wanting bright lines somewhere. And let's see if we can identify some of them. Taking those O'Connor versus Ortega principles, the reasonable expectation of privacy principles forward, if an employer, and then looking at what happened in the Ontario case, if an employer gives an employee a cell phone and says, this is your on-duty cell phone, and we want you to know you have no expectation of privacy in this cell phone, and we can and reserve the right to search the entire contents of the cell phone at any time, could the employer then, after that point, simply search the contents of the cell phone at any time? Because there might not be a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Yeah, the question there will turn on whether you would have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that. And it's a very fact-intensive scenario. And the fact that the client or the officer in that case would have noticed that they have no reasonable expectation of privacy, then that may make it so that they could randomly search it. But if you go back to the Ontario case, which, you know, the Kwan case, the court was very, very conservative in that case. And it's almost a misnomer to think of it as this transcendental cell phone case, because the court really didn't want to go there as far as talking about cell phone rights, because I don't think they really know where they wanted to go yet. In that case, Kwan did have notice that his cell phone, that he didn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in his cell phone, in the sense that there's a computer policy, it said that the department could review him, that he was advised by his lieutenant that the department could review his texts. And the Supreme Court basically said, you know what, we're not even going to go there as far as this discussion about whether or not he did or did not have a reasonable expectation of privacy, because even if he did, and we're going to assume he did have a reasonable expectation of privacy, the search was still valid because it was reasonable in its inception, it was reasonable in its scope. They had basis to think that there was misconduct going on or something was going on because he kept going over the limit, and two, they only searched his on-duty text, and so they felt they narrowly tailored it to find, you know, work-related misconduct.
In Kwan, there was almost this attitude of the Supreme Court in talking to this officer, or was a sergeant, if I remember correctly, saying, look, you should know better. You're using department-issued equipment, and you're communicating over it. You should realize, particularly given your status as a law enforcement officer, this might be evidence. Wasn't that kind of the thrust of what the court was saying to Kwan?
I think that's absolutely right. Now, honestly, I think that if a case like this goes up again, and you have a court that's going to be more aggressive with finding an issue about the reasonable expectation of privacy, I think they're going to say, if you have a scenario like that, where an employer tells their employees, look, you know, if we reserve the right to search this at will or at random, and you know, here it is, you know, you can use it, blah, 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 I think they're going to say you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that, because no reasonable person would think, you know, this is not my property, it's my employer's property, they're giving it to me to, you know, for a specific purpose, and they're telling me that they can search it. Okay, you know, well, I don't think you have a reasonable expectation of privacy there.
Now, let's slightly spin the scenario a little bit, and let's make this not a department-issued cell phone. Let's make it a personal cell phone, and I want to complicate this just a little bit. This is a personal cell phone where the department has a policy that says, you can use this cell phone on duty. You can use your personal phone on duty for personal purposes. But we reserve the right to search it at any time for communications that occur during your work hours. And then a complaint comes in from a motorist. Say a motorist, and this is a scenario that's happened many times around the country, a motorist who's involved in a DWI or something like that, and the motorist looks out while number of officers are processing the stop, looks out and sees one of the officers using his or her personal cell phone. And the motorist then submits a complaint to the department saying misconduct. That what that person was doing with the cell phone, what that officer was doing with the cell phone was inappropriate, might have been communicating about my arrest, might have been taking a picture, whatever it might have been. So here's just summarizing this scenario is personal cell phone used on duty during work hours where the department has announced in advance you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Can the department look at that cell phone for records associated around the time of that DWI stop? And if it can it even search more broadly because of the rule it has announced?
Okay.
In five words or less.
So the first step would be, you know, does he have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the phone, the officer? Because again, if he doesn't, then they can search it. They can basically search it without any cause. If he does, then we need to get back into this O'Connor rule. If you're going from Kwan, you know, the court in that case, even though they tried to back away from it, that they did just kind of say, you know what, we're going to assume he had the reasonable expectation of privacy, and that was in the phone or a device that was given by the employer. I think, and this is kind of an area where I think, you know, the law is still vague because there's no ruling on this specific issue yet. And I do think that this may be something that will change over time because depending on who's, I mean, you know, what court's hearing this case, the Supreme Court, and depending, you know, I don't know if they tweet, if they use Facebook, if they do that kind of stuff and consider a phone a very serious private thing. Younger people might, I'm sure they do. But just, I think from going from Kwan, you're going to have to just assume, I think, based upon that rule, that if it's a personal cell phone, despite the notice, I think you're still going to have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And that's just because that's what the Supreme Court assumed in Kwan, and that's the best we have right now on that ruling.
And let me interject something, because I wanted to emphasize something that you said earlier about the Supreme Court and these you know, newer communications forms, communications technologies. If you go back to the oral argument in the Kwan case, which you can find online at this website called OYEZ.com, you will see genuine confusion on the part of not just one of the justices on the Supreme Court, but also one of the lawyers arguing the case as to what a cell phone and what a pager are. Basic confusion over that. And so, I totally understand what you're saying when you say, you know, the Supreme Court, that's largely made up of people over 70 years old right now, really struggles with this issue of what these technologies are and what they mean in people's lives, right?
Absolutely. And I think to illustrate the point more, you know, in our lives, you know, why cell phones are such a contentious issue, I think, is because, you know, in our lives, you act a certain way at work. You have a certain work life. You have a certain work or, you know, way you act with your significant other. Maybe you have a different way that you act with your friends. We all wear many hats in our lives, and the cell phone, though, what's so concerning, I think, about a cell phone is you have all that life, all that information you have, your interests, your conversations with intimate people, your private work conversations that maybe, you know, confidential, things like that. That's all on this device. My cell phone has my work email on it. You know, my cell phone has contacts of clients and personal people. My cell phone has text messages that I've sent to my fiance and vice versa and stuff like that. I wouldn't want anybody searching that phone. But if you ask my mother about the phone, she doesn't even use one. She still has a landline. To her, it's unfathomable that something like this could happen. You know, so if Justice Scalia isn't, you know, sitting in San Francisco's Mission District, you know, in skinny jeans, tweeting all the time. And so I don't think he understands this. You know, in his world, it's not that ubiquitous thing. But if someone else, it might be. So, yeah, that is kind of the issue where I think there might be room for growth in this. But going on with the fact pattern.
But I've got to interject, Stephen. This image you just pictured of Justice Scalia in the Mission District in skinny jeans, I'm going to have to purge that from my brain. I'm sorry. But okay, back to our fact scenario. So,
or fact pattern.
You're assuming there is an expectation of privacy. That doesn't mean, though, that the department can't search that phone, right? When we have this complaint from the DWI suspect.
That is absolutely right. It doesn't mean that they can't search it. This is kind of another vague area, and the vague area is what is the amount of suspicion or cause that they need to search that phone? If you listen to the podcast and if you read my my letter, or I know you've read it too, my stance on that is they have to have reasonable suspicion of work-related misconduct in order to search the phone without a warrant. How I think we get to the reasonable suspicion, and this part, again, this is not black-letter law yet. This is just more, you know, reading other cases, trying to distill their principles and applying it to this fact scenario. There's a case out of Los Angeles called Kirkpatrick versus City of Los Angeles. In that case, the Ninth Circuit case, long story short, is an officer, a group of officers were accused of taking property from someone they had arrested. The department, in order just to kind of prove that this was a frivolous complaint, which it ended up being, ordered the officers to be strip searched at the department. I believe it was in the locker room. And they didn't have any of this contraband on them. And the officers turned around and sued the department, saying they violated their rights for searching them in that way. The Ninth Circuit agreed and said that in order to search someone like that, they needed reasonable suspicion because it was a search that was highly intrusive. So now we're kind of going back to what I was talking about with Scalia and the skinny jeans and tweeting versus, you know, me tweeting. To me, searching a cell phone search is obviously not a strip search. But I do think that the way that this phone, this technology has integrated itself into people's lives, searching through someone's phone, an employer searching through someone's phone, to me, is extremely intrusive. Like I said, I have so much data on that cell phone that I wouldn't want my employer going through and seeing texts that I send to friends, texts that I send to my fiance, texts that I received back and forth, things I've tweeted, work emails, all sorts of things, photographs from vacations, all sorts of things. So I do think that it's highly intrusive. And on that basis, I think that the department has to have reasonable suspicion that there's some wrongdoing before they can get to that phone.
Let's take the DWI situation and just ask about, with this amount of reasonable suspicion. And what I want to pose to you is we have an internal affairs complaint from a DWI suspect who says, and I'll put some specificity on it, during my arrest, I saw Officer Jones using her cell phone to take a picture of me. Is that reasonable suspicion to access that phone? I know we're going to talk about in a moment what access means and whether it can be limited, but is that reasonable suspicion to access the phone?
Well, reasonable suspicion is defined as some articulable facts that would suggest that there is some sort of wrongdoing afoot. Is just a complaint sufficient for reasonable suspicion? Representing these officers, obviously, I would say no, because you get so many frivolous complaints, especially in a situation like that, where the likelihood of retaliation against a peace officer is high. How does this person know a phone is being taken? He may have been on his phone, but it could have been for work-related purpose. Does she see a flash? What's going on there? Did anybody else see it? Any of the other officers there, if there were any? So there's obviously a lot of facts to argue about. If it's just a comment, I saw him on the phone, I'm assuming that he's taking a picture of me, and therefore I'm complaining, I don't think so. But maybe if she says, I saw a flash go off, he made a comment, he laughed at me, then maybe you do have reasonable suspicion. It's always a fact-intensive scenario, right? You're always going to have to dive into those things.
And might there be, in this sort of circumstance, given the breadth of information that could be on an employee's personal cell phone, might there be an obligation on the part of the department before it orders the production of the cell phone to check the allegation, to talk to the other, we're talking about police officers, this could easily arise with firefighters, corrections officers, any public safety employees, to check with the other employee witnesses on the scene to see whether or not they saw the phone used in the manner described by the suspect. Might there be an obligation to do that sort of preliminary inquiry?
I would say there's always that obligation. If there is other witnesses or other evidence available, they had better check that evidence before they come to you trying to claim that, we got this complaint and it's completely uncooperated, and therefore we're going to search your phone. To me, that's definitely not reasonable in the sense that it's not reasonable. The complaint's not reasonable in its inception, and it probably isn't reasonable in its scope in the sense that the department is just jumping to this search without checking to see whether they even need to go there. Now, it doesn't mean that the department always has to limit you know, it searches the least intrusive means. But I do think that if there's evidence available that can kind of confirm or deny their suspicions before they get to that phone, that they have an obligation to do that.
Now let's assume in our scenario that our drunk driving suspect says, "Hey, I saw the flash. I think he was taking a photograph of me. And then I saw him make motions with his fingers on the phone that suggested that the image was being forwarded through text message or through email." The department does this preliminary investigation, talks to other officers at the scene, and they say, "Yeah, we saw the flash. We thought he was texting something. We didn't know what it was." Now we've got reasonable suspicion. I think you'd probably agree with that. We have reasonable suspicion where the department can get access to that phone. And the question then becomes, what can the department access on that phone?
Sure. So now again, we keep going back to that O'Connor case, right? Now you're looking at the second prong. The second prong is the search has to be reasonable in its scope, which means it has to be conducted in a reasonable manner. I can tell you from my personal experience, and I've had these kind of cases before, and I've only had it, I've only had one where they've gotten to the phone like that, where we weren't doing it voluntarily, I think once. Often I would just give it up because it's exculpatory and it proves that my client wasn't doing anything wrong. But in a situation like that, what I've done in the past is I said, okay, what is your reasonable suspicion and what are you looking for? And they've always told me, and in that one situation they told me. And what we did is, because the way that they get this info off the phones normally in order to store the data for their investigation is, my understanding is they got to dump the contents of the phone basically onto, you know, a hard drive somewhere. They plug something in, they dump it off of this hard drive, and that's how they get it. But obviously that gets everything. And if they get everything, but they're looking for something specific, that's unreasonable. And go back to my comment about the paperweight in the envelope. You know, obviously it's unreasonable for your boss to think that his paperweight's in your envelope, therefore he's going to look in the envelope. Same thing, you know, if an officer stops the car and he's looking for it, he has reasonable suspicion to think there's an AR-15 in the car, and he can't look in the glove compartment for it. What I did in that situation, and I think what is a very kind of reasonable way to go about it, is I said, okay, well, you get your IT guy up here. He'll do the data dump. I'll stand with him. And I think in that case, they were getting text messages. I'll stand with him, and he will have to delete everything that's not text messages, and then he'll have to delete all the text messages that are outside of the dates that you're asking for. And then the investigator wasn't watching, so he couldn't, you know, inadvertently see something, and this guy did it himself, this IT guy. And then once I was certain that everything was deleted, but the things that I thought they could get, we ended it there. So they have to limit their search to what the reasonable suspicion is likely to lead to as far as confirming or denying their suspicions. So in this case, right, you know, you probably look through their photographs on that day and the sent text on that day and on that hour or two. But if they're looking outside of that, it's unreasonable. And the way to, you know, physically do it, I think you're going to have to do it in a way like we did it, if you can't just forward it yourself or take a screenshot or something.
Okay. Now, let's say there's a dispute about this. Let's say that the department is saying to an officer, produce your personal cell phone. I say officer because, and I catch myself because we're using a police officer scenario. Could be any public employee. The employer is saying, produce your cell phone, and the employee is saying, you don't have reasonable suspicion, and I don't want to produce my cell phone. How does that issue get resolved in the context of a pending internal affairs investigation? Just practically, what happens? Does somebody go to court? What goes on?
Yeah. Fortunately, I've never had the situation come up yet, but of course you always try to prepare for what you would do. I think the first thing I would do, because the thing with this stuff, and the thing that's always kind of wonky about internal affairs investigations is, you know, generally your exclusionary rule can apply, but it's very weak, and you've got to get an arbitrator that's going to have strength of personality to say that you can't use a certain piece of evidence. And so with that in mind, I usually don't want to do the whole, you know, comply now and grieve later issue. I don't want to get the cat out of the bag if I don't think they have a lawful right to get to it. And I think the only way you do that without getting your client fired for insubordination is because that's also always the other thing you're concerned about when you're representing public employees is if you're giving them counsel to ignore or defy an order, regardless of whether it's lawful or not, you might walk them down an insubordination point that you can't get back out of, or that you'll take a long time and lots of money to get out of. If it's feasible, as far as money and your ability to prosecute it, I think you got to file for an injunctive, some kind of injunctive relief, get a temporary restraining order, and try to get injunctive relief against the department in Superior Court to prevent them from getting to the phone. That's probably the best way to do it. Obviously, that's costly. You need to be able to pay for a lawyer if you don't have some kind of defense fund that pays for you, or union dues that pay for you. And it could be expensive and maybe not worth it, unfortunately, but that I think is the best way to do it. The only other way I could see dealing with it is, the old adage of in labor law, which is you comply now and grieve later. You give it up, that specific thing they're looking for, and then file a grievance or attempt to get it excluded if you're in some kind of labor arbitration or whatever appeal process that particular union has.
Okay. Now, let's try to tie the knot on this and expand our fact situation just a little bit. This time, let's say the allegation of misconduct, and let's say the allegation of misconduct is against a firefighter, is an off-duty allegation. And the allegation is that the firefighter has been using his or her cell phone in a way that the department thinks amounts to, say, it's conduct unbecoming or a violation of the department's rules. Say, for example, the allegation is this firefighter's using his cell phone to harass his former spouse, making hang-up calls. Or this firefighter is using his cell phone to send out X-rated pictures of himself. Whatever the allegation might be. Does any of this analysis that we've talked about change because the allegation is related to off-duty conduct rather than on-duty conduct?
Yes, it does. And the reason why is, and the short answer is, in that situation, that's where I think a warrant is required or some other heightened scrutiny. I would say a warrant for the records. And the reason is, if you remember, we went back and we talked about the Fourth Amendment and reasonable searches and the general warrant requirement and all of the exceptions to the warrant requirement. Well, O'Connor's warrant requirement talked about work-related searches or misconduct. If you've got a firefighter who is being alleged of maybe he sent some, harassing, not illegal, but harassing, comments to a former spouse, and the spouse complains to the department. To me, that's not work-related misconduct. That's not within their purview, even though it can kind of, they'll try to say it's conduct unbecoming and that kind of stuff. But hey, if he's not putting his job into the situation, not trying to use his office to threaten somebody, you see that more with police officers, where they get into scuffles or something off duty, and then the person they get in the scuffle with finds out they're a cop somehow, and then files a complaint. Unless the person is putting their job into that, that's not work-related misconduct. That is non-work-related misconduct, and therefore this whole O'Connor thing that we've been talking about, this entire conversation, doesn't apply. And then you just go back to, you need a warrant for that. So that's where your most, that's where your privacy interests are strongest. Non-work related misconduct on a personal cell phone.
And what if the non-work related misconduct, if proven, might be a crime?
If it's a crime, then that is definitely, you go into your traditional, the O'Connor thing, I don't think even applies to that, because the O'Connor thing was very specific about non-investigatory work-related purpose, which I believe has been interpreted as, you know, this isn't about criminal investigations. This is about, you know, your internal affair rule violations. If it's some kind of criminal thing, you know, he sends, death threats to somebody, that situation where, you know, the police department needs to go through the normal channels, which I think in that case would be they have to, seize that phone through, some sort of legal means, whether it be search incident to arrest or something like that, and get a warrant to take the phone off. Take the data off the phone. Although right now, there is a case pending in front of the Supreme Court talking about whether or not they can conduct a search incident to arrest that will lead to your cell phone, and that's a whole other issue, and I don't know what the answer to that's going to be.
That's a criminal law case, though, that's pending before the Supreme Court, right?
Yeah, that is a criminal law case. It's not an admin case, but under this scenario where it's a crime, you know, that could be relevant to that.
But what if the employer is saying, look, if you commit this crime off-duty with your cell phone, let's say it's a crime that involves, let's make it absolutely worst-case scenario here, the distribution or viewing of child pornography. Let's say the department is saying, look, we don't care what's going on the criminal end, whether somebody's deciding to prosecute you or not. The fact that you have, or there's, in our judgment, a reasonable belief that you have committed an off-duty crime using this device, that would disqualify you from employment with us. Does that give the department the right in an administrative investigation to get that phone?
I still don't think so. I think they still would need the warrant, and I would go back to, it may be work-related, but it's not a non-investigatory work-related search. It's beyond, even though it's an IA, I would still characterize that as, you know, you were doing an administrative investigation, but it really is a criminal investigation, and we're not going to give that up absent a warrant. That could be something that if that case came up, which I don't think it has, as far as being litigated in any federal jurisdiction. That really, my opinion might be wrong, but definitely the stance that I would take with the client is, I don't think that the law as is, I don't think there's a bright line, black letter rule here that will allow them to get that phone.
And Stephen, one last point. Is it accurate to say we just don't have enough cases on any of this yet to do much more than try to anticipate what the rulings may be based upon these broad legal principles that we've been discussing?
I think it's accurate to a degree. Like I said, there's many points in, obviously I have my framework distilling principles down just to what I think is proper or not proper. But there are no bright line rules for some of those areas. For example, my reasonable suspicion belief, I believe it's grounded in well thought out, principles, but there is no law, there's no court out there that said, yeah, Bess's theory is right. There's nobody out there that has said that yet. So there are a lot of questions to still be settled with this. And like I kind of said before at the Kwan Court, the courts are very, very concerned with this because they're not exactly sure how to deal with the cell phone issue yet. And I think that's because, as we kind of talked about a little bit, this is a transcendental, transformative technology. And really, really talking about, really blew up with the invention of the iPhone. I think that was in 2007 when that came out in the market. So it's really not been a long time. We're talking less than a decade where these kind of powerful devices are really out there and ubiquitous, where everybody has them and everybody's putting their information on it. And I think that the courts really are looking at this issue and they're trying to put the brakes down on it and say, you know what, we want to see how this phone thing plays out. It's a technology that's not going to go away. And it's probably as time goes on, people are going to come to find them to be more and more private, more and more more and more of a private extension of their thoughts, their feelings, and their property. So I think that there are a lot of unresolved issues still. I think that we can come to a basic, we can come to a reasonable, good faith belief as to where we think the law is. But it's going to be a while, I think, before courts really have the fortitude to go out and say, this is the bright line rule here, this is the bright line rule there, and this is where the bright line is over there.
Yeah. Well, great. Stephen Betts, thank you so much for joining us and kind of filling us in on this area that I think is a huge mystery to everybody. Thanks again for willing to share your thoughts with us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Okay. And folks, that's it. We will, as developments occur in this area, we'll certainly keep you up to speed on them. Check our webpage. You will see some links to the article that Stephen referred to, as well as some of the cases in the area. We'll post links to the Kwan versus City of Ontario and the O'Connor versus Ortega cases. Well, that's it, folks. Thanks for joining us for this special edition of Labor Relations Information Systems Podcast. I'm Will Aitchison, and we hope to see you next time for our regular First Thursday podcast.